Are you looking after someone aged, a person with a disability, or someone with a mental illness or medical condition? As a carer, you can access free support online, over the phone, or in person. Carer Gateway is an Australian government initiative providing counselling, advice, respite, and much more. Find out how Carer Gateway can help you. Call 1800 422 737, Monday to Friday, or visit carergateway.gov.au. Carer Gateway, connecting carers to support services. A 3CR supporter.
Hi there, my name's Gemma Mahadio, and you're listening to 3CR's Imagining Disability Justice, a special International Day of People with Disability broadcast.
The 3CR Disability Day 2020 broadcast is proudly supported by the City of Yarra through an Investing in Community grant. The following is a fantastic conversation between Banamali Hermans and Mario Pozega on 3CR's show Chronically Chilled. They talk about Black Lives Matter, abolition, mutual aid, and more. Banamali, or Mali for short, is a Wiradjuri, Irish, and Flemish woman living on Ngunnawal and Ngambri land. She is a disabled organiser and writer and has appeared on numerous podcasts. Mali is a board member of Women with Disabilities ACT and currently works in gender-based violence policy alongside studying a Master of Social Work. The following was recorded in the midst of Black Lives Matter protests and in the middle of the pandemic.
I feel like for a lot of people, especially thinking of Black people, thinking of mob here, thinking of disabled people, thinking of anyone who's on, I guess, like the front line of not only the pandemic, but also this very big political uprising. Yeah, it's a really tiring time for a lot of people. I think I feel very lucky I did not lose my job during COVID and I've been able to work from home. So there've been some silver linings for me and that's kind of made work a lot more bearable, with chronic illness. Mm-hmm. But just tired, hey. It's a lot. And I think too, I recently had my mum pass away. And so COVID and the pandemic has really stuffed up my grieving timeline, you know what I mean? It's not a normal trajectory. So that's been pretty tough. But yeah, feeling pretty lucky to be healthy right now.
Yeah.
I'm really healthy as I can be.
Yeah, I'm really sorry to hear about your mum.
Thank you.
Yeah. What's helping you kind of get through this time? Because I think we've all been kind of trying to deal with it as best as we can and stuff. What's been helping you?
Writing a lot. Been writing heaps, although a lot of it is stuff that I'll probably never publish ever, but definitely writing, journaling as well. Big fan of journaling. And I think too, just the amount of events now that I can tune into online. I went to Overland's launch last night and normally, you know, I feel like it's a different kind of culture now where a lot of events would stream their events, but it's just not the same as everyone tuning in together online. So I think I've been doing a lot of that for a lot of social interactions. That's been nice. And then also just getting outside and going on long walks has been very grounding and very good. I was joking to a friend the other day, I feel like the bushfires felt like preparation for COVID because we were just stuck inside for 5 weeks when the air was too toxic to breathe. Doing those little things to ground me, I think.
Of course, because in Canberra it was really bad, wasn't it, all the bushfires?
It was pretty bad. A few days we were the worst air quality in the world. We had to move our mattresses into our living room because that's the only place we have air conditioning. And then we would duct tape up the kind of gaps in our doors and we'd put wet towels as if there were a house fire. But there wasn't a house fire, it was just the smoke. You know, I'm a renter, so it just got in. It's a very old house. It's pretty suffocating. Yeah. And I have asthma as well, so I was like, oh gosh.
A lot of people have been commenting about the accessibility of having online events and stuff now, being a huge, making a huge difference in people's lives. What other things have you noticed that, like, you kind of want to hold on to, like, post-pandemic?
I think, like, on a material level, the $550 coronavirus supplement first comes to mind. Definitely want to hold on to that. And I also want it extended to the DSB and the carers pension, like, without a question. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that is kind of a fight that, although it's part of the Keep the Rate campaign, has kind of been left behind a little bit. And I think a lot of, like, mainstream economic justice activists haven't really grasped, like, how expensive it is to be disabled during a pandemic. Like, you know, it's groceries delivered, getting medications delivered, changing, like, I've had to change my medications during COVID. Yeah. So definitely the supplement. Telehealth, also amazing. Love that. But I think on a different level too, just like, I don't know, I feel like socially, we're kind of, I feel like I at least am living my life at a slower pace. And I saw people tweeting the other day about crip time, and I haven't ever really used the word or phrase crip time before, but I'm like, yes, that's what this is for me. Like, I feel like my body's getting to recover. But at the same time, like, slowing down a bit, I'm like, yeah. I've been going way too fast, and I didn't realize, like, just how bad it, like, it was having an effect on my body. Yeah. So definitely want to keep that. But also, I think the one thing I would say is that I'm a bit hesitant to say that COVID has just been, like, all silver linings and that there are heaps of things you want to keep. Like, because I think about my dad, who's also disabled, and, like, he can't use the internet. You know what I mean? So I feel for older people and for people who maybe don't have access to the internet, like, all these things that have opened up for us actually are governed by a huge digital divide still. And I think we really have to be, like, aware of that.
Totally. Yeah. My dad has got some, like, health issues as well. And they organized a telehealth appointment for him, and he can barely speak English. So telehealth has been awesome for me. But for my dad, like, he's not going to get anything out of it.
Exactly.
Why the doctors even organized that, I have no idea. And you're just like, you know, for some people this stuff has been really good, and for other people it hasn't. And I think
it's easy
because you don't actually hear from those people very often around.
Exactly, yeah, because, like, what is, you know, their entryway into mainstream discourse? They're not going to be tweeting about their shit experiences on Twitter. They don't use Twitter, you know what I mean? Yeah, like,
I think it's up to us not to forget them as well.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Let's talk abolition stuff.
Yes. I love it.
So, yeah, what's emerged from the Black Lives Matter movements is, like, a real surge in, like abolitionist politics and conversations about what that would look like. Mm. I never thought that we would get to this point so quickly, I guess. I don't know what other people
think. No, neither did I. Yeah.
But intersecting with this is also, like, incredibly high levels of incarceration and institutionalization faced by people with disabilities. Can you talk more about it?
Yeah, for sure. First, I'd preface and say, like, yeah, I never thought it would be in my lifetime that, like, abolitionist politics would actually be, like, you know, this, like, critical moment where it's actually a global discussion. Like, that is just beyond me, and I feel really lucky to be watching everything unfold. I think I've been interested in abolition for a couple of years, and obviously that stemmed from, like, classics like Our Prison's Obsolete by Angela Davis. And I didn't really incorporate that disability justice lens until my own family's experiences with institutionalization. So following a suite of different hospital stays, my mum, her only option was to live in a group home from around early 2018 up until her death. And I didn't understand what group homes were. But she was a quadriplegic, and she had a level of needs that just the NDIS was not willing to fund in her own house. She was locked away in a group home with four other women with disabilities, and it was an institution the way it was run, like, you know, run to a set schedule. It was not a home in the way that you would, you know, consider a home. You were constantly being the only word I can say is like policed and like your different behaviors and things like that. And that was when I was like, shit, like she's been separated from the community and she's never going to be allowed back into the community because of her disabilities. And so I think, yeah, that was when I kind of grew my idea of abolition to not only prisons, but like what actually are carceral institutions. So like, how do we disappear people and how do we lock people away? In prisons, of course, but in group homes and even like looking at nursing homes, for instance. And I think I saw a tweet yesterday or the day before, and it was just so beautifully put. It was so succinct. It was like, abolition is care. And to me, I'm like, that is at the root of abolitionist politics to me. It's like transforming not only justice, so investing in transformative justice, but also transforming the way that we care for one another so that we don't have to rely on institutions like group homes. We don't have to rely on nursing homes and, you know, lock older folks away. I think that's incredibly important. And yeah, like even thinking of the pandemic, like what is it? It's up to 45% or so of people in the US who have died as a result of COVID have been people in nursing homes. Mm. That's not only older folks, but disabled folks have been institutionalized there too. Mm. And like the amount of people in our prisons now who have disabilities, it's like up to half of everyone. It's the same, like even looking at police brutality, like the amount of people killed by police is like up to 50% of people. And I think, you know, that's an intersection that we have to always be very mindful of. And especially like, I think in the disability rights movement, it can be very wide and people often forget about, you know, Black and Indigenous experiences of disability as well, and how things like mental illness or what people might call psychosocial disability, like, you know, that's read very differently if you're a Black person. And that can lead to, you know, your institutionalization or death if you're angry about being fucking oppressed.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think this is like such an exciting time. And I am so here for all the different discussions about care and what community might look like for people who have been shut away from community for so long.
Mm. I think what makes this really hard is Australia loves to like lock people up. And it loves the police. And I think, I think we've all been trained in some ways to be deputies as well and to police each other. And it's also another layer to all of this. We're very quick to kind of dob each other in. And, you know, I'm thinking also about homeless people. We're very quick to kind of just call the cops on homeless people, for example, rather than kind of looking at the larger structural kind of disadvantage and oppression that they face as well.
Yeah,
you know? So I think there's lots of different communities and lots of different groups that I think we need to kind of include in all this as well.
Sure. I think first and foremost, it necessitates a lot of our work being led by people who have experienced incarceration, who've experienced institutionalization, who have experienced homelessness, for instance, because, frankly, I don't think people understand the psychological effect that being disappeared or being locked away has, unless, you've lived it. So I think that that is like a really important aspect to the conversation. Just on a root level, I don't think we can talk about abolitionist politics in Australia without talking about colonialism, without talking about like what is the history of prisons, you know, why do we use prisons in Australia? Like, this was a fucking penal colony, you know, when it was invaded to start off with. And it's hard to see it because it, ever since 1788, it has literally been the purpose of this place, of this settlement, has been to imprison people. And I think until that is actually grappled with, like, you know, what's the point? You can't. Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah.
Yeah,
that's definitely the first. The first point. Yeah, and I guess it's what's been. I was kind of comparing kind of what's happening in the US compared to what's been happening in Australia, and I think the US has stayed really, really focused in terms of this is about this is about Black people being killed by the police, and this is about ending kind of defunding police or abolishing police or all that stuff. And I feel like the conversation in Australia has already been diverted. Like it went from about Aboriginal deaths in custody, which it, this is kind of where it's all about. And it's been diverted into pop culture and statues and stuff. And I think the government, with the help of the media, has really kind of done that. I think kind of done a really good sneakily job of kind of diverting
360,
the conversation. Yeah, they've diverted the conversation kind of already.
Yeah.
So I guess it's like, and this is a hard question as well, but like how do we kind of stay focused and kind of, you know,
how are you so
not
focused?
Get diverted? Yeah, yeah.
Well, I think I would say that, like, organisers of Black deaths in custody rallies have stayed focused. Like, you know, we've been doing this shit for fucking years. And I think it's up to people who suddenly have seen this political moment in the US and they've recognised it in the Australian context, but making sure that it's not just, like, a one-off thing for people. Like, it's, like, in the US, I think people are realising, like, as an ally or as whatever, as an organizer or someone who's invested in transformative justice, I need to commit, you know, my time, my organizing, my resources to this cause. And I still think that that is something that's very far off for a lot of people in Australia. And I see a lot of people commenting, and I agree to a large extent, that they can empathize with the struggles of Black people in the US and not empathize with, you know, our struggles, mob struggles here in Australia. And how to change that. Like, I see so many amazing deadly mob on Twitter and in my life doing such staunch, amazing work. People keep going on, but it's like there's only so much you can do to turn, you know what I mean? Like, I feel like
it's up to the rest of us,
Literally, yeah. And yes, steering the conversation back to that's such a hard question. Like, I just, the Australian media, like, I just, like, it's a beast that just cannot, like, how the fuck does Pauline Hanson still have, like, a regular Channel 7 slot? Like, yeah, I just, like,
Yeah, it's been so normalised, like, and that's what I was saying before, we've normalised locking people up, and asylum seekers as well, you know, with, like, huge support from, like, the population, and I think, like, that whole thing about how we treat disabled people as well. Like, that's also been so normalized.
Totally.
Yeah. So when we're talking about abolition, what do you think it could look like from a disability justice perspective?
From a disability justice perspective, I think coming back to that conversation around care, I think it definitely looks like completely transforming the way that we care for each other. And also, like, how do we even talk about disability? Like, obviously the social model of disability is what policymakers use, right?
But I
don't think that's true from my own experience of disability, from my family's experiences of disability. It is just medicalizing people and problematizing people and, you know, pushing this narrative that people are a fucking burden and that, you know, they need to be managed in some way. And I think, like, programs like the NDIS that are supposed to be about empowerment and choice and control are not actually about those things, and similarly push those narratives onto people that, like, you are a problem, you need to be managed and shit like that. And so, like, actually bringing in abolitionist perspectives to that just seems so far off to me. But how do we do it? I think conversations around care, and I think too, some of the mutual aid we've been seeing are really, really, really good examples, like, not only during COVID, but during the bushfires too, because it shows that as a community, you know, we can sustain each other, we can distribute resources amongst each other, and we can ensure people's needs are met without making them feel like a burden. You know what I mean? Like, we can be like, hey, do you, to my neighbor next door, do you need a puffer? I've got a spare puffer. Here's a puffer for you. And I think those are, like, some of the very elemental first steps that we're seeing and that can lead us down that pathway.
Yeah. It's really, you've already talked about the concept of care a few times. And when I was preparing for this, I've actually got care written as something that I kind of think is also really important, and how do we kind of encourage it? And it was really interesting, like, during this whole COVID thing, I feel like we had when this, you know, COVID initially kind of got, you know, became a thing in Australia and stuff. There was initially this kind of, there was a real care for each other in the community and how do we look out for each other and all this kind of stuff. Mm. And I felt like that lasted a few weeks maybe. Then we all just went back to our individual lives and everybody's kind of you know, not even social distancing anymore. And it's all become about rules and all that kind of stuff. So it's and kind like, of yeah, a fleeting thing that we actually, we have a real time, hard time hanging on to, you know.
I think that's a really good point. Like I can see distinct stages in like everyone realizing we're in a global pandemic, like we're in this shared crisis and then it kind of like disintegrating into people panic buying into like this mindset of I have to preserve me and my family and that's it. Like I have to, you know, keep myself safe. And then you raise a really good point, which I totally agree with. It's just like we suddenly lurched into this horrible discourse of let's police each other, let's introduce, you know, restrictions that weren't actually, like, I'm not advocating against a lot of the restrictions that we're seeing, but the way that they've been framed, you know, it's like you're either good or bad if you're following the restrictions, rather actually acknowledging, like, why are we doing what we're doing in the first place? Like, why are we social distancing? It's because there are people in our community who are immunocompromised. It's because, you know, we're connected and we actually have to hold each other accountable to one another and protect each other, you know, in this broader ecosystem. And I think that that has totally been thrown out the door and it's rather about you're not wearing a mask, therefore you're a shit person and I'm going to dob you in, or, you know what I mean? Yeah.
Which is, I think, why it's just like I was talking about things being normalized before. I think that's why, like, when you see people react in Australia to the concept or the idea of abolition, it's kind of one of complete shock, and they just like, what does that even mean? How do we, that does not make it even any sense to me. And I'm not even talking about kind of people who would be against it anyway. I'm talking about people who might be curious about it, but they find it really hard to kind of imagine what that might look like.
Yeah, it's hard to conceptualize it when literally like think of like, you know, the stages of life. Like when you get old, you get put into an old folks home. If you get disabled, or if you, for want of a better word, if you get crippled, you're going to go to an institution. If you're bad, if you break society's rules, you're going to go to an institution. Like that's literally, I remember there was a great Q&A panel with Nina Kagori on it a couple of years ago. I think maybe it was the panel where people were talking about burning shit down. I can't remember properly.
Not the one that got banned. Yeah.
I don't think so, but there was a great quote and it was like, it's literally how Australia deals with problems. Like, we don't know any different. This country does not know any different apart from locking people up.
Totally.
So I think, like, you know, even for people who would consider themselves leftists, it's such a foreign idea.
Absolutely. And you talked before about what we're going to need in this is for people from their, you know, with lived experience and from community to lead this kind of process. But I think there's a real myth around all that stuff as well, around consultation. And I think there's a lot of bullshit consultation that happens. And I think there's a lot of bullshit kind of inclusion kind of stuff that happens. And, you know, when we're talking consultation or when we're talking that kind of stuff, we're really talking about process. But process without power is just more systemic abuse.
Totally agree. Me and a friend, I think in metaphors a lot, I find it really easy to visualize. And we came up with a really nice metaphor for this process. And it's like, you know, a lot of people talk about having a seat at the table, or a seat at the dinner table or whatever. I feel like a lot of the time what actually passes at a seat at the dinner table is everyone having a really lovely meal. And the next day they show up at your door with some leftovers and they're like, yeah, we included you. But I feel like, I totally agree. I think consultation's bullshit. And I think, I want to see abolitionist politics, and I want to see politics in this country that is rooted in self-determination and for mob is rooted in sovereignty, you know, like.
Yeah. And in that process, someone has to give up power, I think.
Yeah. And I think too, this is a great conversation to have in the disability community, because I, along with a lot of other disabled people, fucking hate the fact that a lot of
conversations about disability in this country are led by disability service providers, as if service providers or the people who provide us often subpar care or are the people who are, you know, policing us in these institutions are the people who get to speak on disability.
Yeah.
And it's like, I feel like in Australia, when people, you know, see disability, they're like, oh, cool, life without barriers, you know, like they can speak on disability. You know what I mean? It's like,
well, I think, no. I think part of the problem, I think part of the problem is like a lot of these services and also the government as well has seen the solution to disability around, it's all individually based. So in the NDIS, it all sounds great. We're going to give choice to individuals and choice around to people around making decisions about their lives and stuff. But there's actually no collective element in the NDIS, which actually makes it hard for people to actually come together and to organize around it.
Does that, you know,
so there's actually not many spaces at all to actually for disabled people to come together and have these conversations and to organize and to have different ideas and to kind of start to tackle some of these organizations that are really problematic.
I agree. And like, just on a tangent, I'm even thinking of like the Disability Royal Commission. Like I remember one of the first days, one of the first hearings, I'm pretty sure it was on education, and like no people with experience in what I would call segregated education settings got to speak or testify. It was all the teachers and the principals and the teachers unions who were responsible for these settings in the first place. And it's just like, you know, but people would see the Disability Royal Commission and be like, great, disabled people are being heard. And I think, that's one of my pet peeves is that consultation is not the same as self-determination. I think.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's really well said. Yeah. So you've already talked about mutual aid. So I think that's one of the things also that's come out of COVID-19 is there's been a big rise in kind of mutual aid organising. And it suggests there's really a failure of services kind of to respond to especially marginalised communities. And I'm thinking also disabled people who, you know, a lot of people are still isolating and stuff. So can you explain a little bit more about mutual aid and kind of a little bit more about your experiences?
Yeah, so I think that is a good way of putting it. Mutual aid is when the state does fail to provide, you know, material resources for people. But I've recently been having conversations with friends and other disabled activists, and I like their way of framing it too. It's like, well, you know, mutual aid might be the phrase we call it now that's in, but really we've kind of been doing this for a very long time and it's how our communities have survived. Like we wouldn't always necessarily call it mutual aid, but it's like sharing resources with one another, you know, and making sure that if you know someone doesn't have access to something and you do have access to it, opening that up. And it comes back again, like I don't want to keep saying this word, but a different way of care where, you know, you realize it's within my power to help this person. If I have this resource, I'm going to share it. I'm going to be very cognizant of their needs and be cognizant that their needs probably are not going to be met by the state.
That was disabled organizer and writer Vanamali Hermans. You can listen to all of Chronically Chilled's episodes via podcast, which you can find at 3cr.org.au. So if you search for Chronically Chilled on the site, you'll be able to find us there. You can also follow us on iTunes as well if you would like. I just want to thank Mali again for coming onto the show, and also thank you for listening.
Hi, I'm Nakayan.
I'm Liv.
I'm Warwick.
And you're listening to Imagining Disability Justice on 3CR.
A 12-hour broadcast for International Day of Disability.
Stay tuned.
The Boldness, campaigning for human rights for people with disabilities. Join us every third Wednesday of the month at 6 p.m. on 3CR.